cancer.
Oh.
And I went to Caltech and studied under Professor H.S.C.N. I think you spell that T-S-I-E-N, who later went back to China and is the father of the Chinese rocket system that they're selling to all the rebel countries today. So I got by that one too, amazingly enough, and I got a degree as aeronautical engineer, which I was in the PhD program, but what do you know, 1950, the Vietnam War breaks out.
Korean War.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh yes, the Korean War. I'm mixed up again. So I get orders to an air group. Stop what you're doing and run. So have you ever flown a Corsair? Yes, I've flown a Corsair. Well, jump in and let's get some carrier landings. I have to practice carrier landings because I've been out of the thing for 3 years. And so I have to practice a little bit. So we have 1 week before we embark. Okay, that means get out of the country. I left my poor wife in a rented house with all the boxes in the living room filled with our stuff. And she had to put everything away, I guess. And off to sea I went again. I was assigned being now a technical officer as the air group maintenance and operations officer. So more or less the assistant air group commander, because I was rather senior. I was as senior as most of the squadron commanders, and so they couldn't put me in a squadron. So that's where I was.
What was the responsibility?
And my responsibility was to check on the maintenance of all of the airplanes and keep a count of the numbers that were up, and if there were problems in getting enough airplanes, to find out what the problems were and see if I could fix it. And I did bring some of my technical knowledge to bear during the Korean War in the winter time. And we did hit the winter time in December and January. It was cold, boy, it was cold. We'd have a little snow on the flight deck, and it was down close to zero. Well, we were very frequently used napalm bombs, which is a powder you put in a gas tank with a fuse on it. And when you drop that on the ground, it explodes and spreads the fire all the way for half a mile or so. Quite effective in destroying a lot of stuff, even troops. And, the gasoline and the powder, the napalm powder, would not mix at 0 degrees. So I put a recommendation into the captain, let's heat the gasoline. He blew up. He said, what are you talking about, heat the gasoline? I said, well, you can heat the gasoline with a steam pipe, you know, running through the gasoline. It's not going to ignite. It's not going to burn. Well, of course, they have to go and bunch of messages all the way back to Washington to view ships to get the technical go-ahead. Sure. They said, yep, go ahead and try it. So they tried it and it worked.
Well, that's great.
So I did have an idea. You heated the gasoline to a normal high temperature, like 60 degrees or something like that, with a steam pipe. We had plenty of steam because we had steam catapults at that time, so we were using it. And we were just using it anyway. And so that was a problem solved. Well, anyway, I came back from that, and I got a squadron command for to go back to Korea again, and this was in jets. And I had never flown a jet before, but I got somebody to check me out, and I flew them, and I was elated. Now I'm flying jets, boy, and that was a good idea. And I had a wonderful squadron on that group of guys. We were out for 8 months. I had 22 pilots, 18 airplanes, and I came back with 18 pilots and 22 airplanes still flying. And that was a record in the Pacific for many, many years. I don't know if it was ever broken or not. And of course I was pretty tickled with that, because I could say, well, we made it.
That's good.
After Korea, let's see, what happened then?
What was your rank at the end of Korea, by the way?
I was a senior lieutenant commander when I'd taken over the jet squadron. And this was 52. And a month after that, I'd make commander. So I was a three-stripe commander at that time. Mm-hmm. And, I was ordered back to Washington to Beau Air. And because of my technical schooling, I was put in fighter design. Now, fighter design is the officer in charge of a project with various civilian professionals under him in the bureau, like one for safety, one for power plants, one's for airframes, another one's for fuel lines or something like that, or another one for communications and so forth and so on. So you have a team under you to check the designs of airplanes that the Navy wants to buy, and sometimes to submit from the contractor any contractor ideas up to the OPNAV, who decides what we'll buy them.
Could you explain what OPNAV is?
The OPNAV being the operational part of the Washington thing under the Chief of Naval Operations.
Bureau of Naval Operations.
The Chief of Naval Operations. And we call it OPNAV, meaning Naval Operations. Mm-hmm. And he has a staff that decides how many airplanes to buy, and what do we want to do with them, what kind of operations we want to do with them. And they have to meet certain criteria. And those criteria come down to the technical guys who say, well, we need this kind of stuff and this kind of stuff to meet that kind of criteria.
Do you remember any of the names of the planes that
oh yeah,
that you were project chief of?
I was assigned to the Douglas desk, and the Douglas had the
they made the Phantom, right?
The Douglas Aircraft Company, and I had the F-4D Skyray was a new fighter that Douglas proposed, and we had to look it over to see if it would meet our operational requirements. The F-3D was another aircraft that was more or less an observation utility aircraft that might be used for the Marine Corps. I think they bought some of those. They also had a rocket plane that broke the speed record or something like that. Of course, we weren't interested particularly in that type, but we were interested, of course, in the technical aspects of how they did it and could it be used for further designs, with future designs. Anyway, it was a very interesting tour for me, and my wife hated Washington.
Weather is bad.
And anyway, we bought a house there, and in 10 years didn't make any money on it. However, we sold it all right. But I think she stayed there for 8 years in between the first Washington job I went to sea as an air officer. Now the air officer controls the traffic on the carrier, the flight deck and the launching and the traffic pattern around the ship and things like that. And carries out the captain's orders of what he wants to do with the airplanes. Arm them with this or arm them with that. And this was a typical thing because they told me, okay, you got to be an air officer before you get an air group. And because we don't want the air group guy fighting with the air officer all the time about what he does with these airplanes, which was happening. So they made you have an experience of being an air officer, of where to park the airplanes and so forth and so on, and how to service them and all that kind of stuff. So you didn't get in fights with the group commander, who wants other things done. Oh, well, that was pretty smart. The next job I got was the group commander.
When were you appointed group commander?
My group was assigned to Quonset Point, Rhode Island. I moved my family up there. And I was there for 2 years. And that was in 1956. 1956, I started it. Oh boy. And two of the interesting things during the air group tour was that we commissioned a ship in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. We did the flyover. We joined another group of airplanes from Atlantic City, and we had 100 jets, and I was the leader, and I had to fly over Brooklyn Navy Yard at 1,500 feet with 100 jets behind me at 400 knots. You can imagine what the air traffic around New York City was trying to do. Of course, the FAA had put out notices and everything to clear the air. To clear the air and whatnot. But some guys, of course, never get the word. And there was a little Piper Cub or something flying down there that almost got eaten up. We missed him, sure. that was quite interesting anyway. Another rather interesting thing was that we were just about to deploy on an exercise in the North Atlantic. And of course they picked us, no doubt, because the group was ready to go. President Eisenhower wanted to come aboard and see an air group. So I had to explain to the president what was happening, where my airplanes were doing, and I put on an air show for him and everything like that. And after that was over, he invited me to lunch. About 10 other guys. Of course, I sat back in the corner, and kept my mouth shut. Anyway, a highlight. Let's see. So after the air group job, back to Washington. This time, the chief, the admiral of the bureau, says to me, he says, "Welcome aboard," and so forth and so on. "We want you to run the missile department, and let's get the fights stopped between the air group, the fighter design, and the missile group, because the fighter design guys didn't want weights of missiles, and the missiles weren't any good anyway. We want to shoot bullets." And so for the old-time stuff, you know, let's stop, right? We've gotten out of that system now. So we did our best to try to get the missiles to work better. And I think we kind of succeeded. We started what we called the Phoenix missile. And that's still running today, as far as I know. Can you imagine? But I'm sure it's been refined many times. But it was put on the F-14. And, of course, the F-14s have been in service for 20 years. But that was a missile to protect the fleet.
What was the Phoenix missile designed to do, to shoot?
The Phoenix missile was designed to protect the fleet, to shoot an attacker down at 100 miles away after identification, which was the hard part, of course, mm-hmm. to find out who it was that was fooling around out there. But if you expected a group of strikes coming in, and that had been reported to you or whatnot, and you did have, and you did query them with an electronic pulse or something to get an identification, an IFF identification, which means identify friend or foe, and you didn't get an answer, then you could shoot. And this missile was supposed to go 100 miles. I never know how it worked out. I was not in operations again to ever use one. But we did start that, and it was very apparently successful. Where did I go after that? Oh, back to Monterey as a school teacher, as head of the aeronautical engineering section of the graduate school.
That would make this 1958 or 59?
This would be 1960.
60. That's an improvement in the weather over Washington.
Quite a bit. And it was by the seashore, and she loved it, you know. Oh, dear. And we had a nice time in Monterey. That was a nice, relaxing job. I had an old professor that used to lecture me all the time about what they should study, how they should study, and never make up your mind what you want to do when you're before you go to college or while you're in college, just be generalistic. He says, and he says, you have to start pinpointing what you want to do in graduate school. That's where you work. I guess so. I don't know. Not always, huh? But anyway, he was quite an influence on me, I think. Can't remember his name. Oh, well. After a year there, I went back to sea. After 2 years there, I guess. It was 2 years. I went back to sea in 62. Which was turned out to be my last suit duty, as an operations officer of a task force. And in that job, the operations officer runs the task force, runs the whole routine of, first he writes an op order. This tells him what the operation is going to do, what the purpose of it is, how they're going to do it, what kind of formations to use, what kind of ammunition to use, and all that kind of stuff is in the op order. And what the targets are, I suppose. Yes, of course. And but there are changes, of course, that come out after the op order is in possession of everybody, and those have got to be made also. Now, of course, the operations officer writes the op order, and he has a staff of people to do it. I mean, I have about 6 or 8 other officers on the staff. And we present it to the Admiral. He signs it. If he likes it, if he wants to change it, we change it. And then we go out and we operate according to that op order. And every day there might be a change in the schedule, and a change in the ammunition loading, and a change in the number of airplanes going to specific targets, and things like that, or what formations to take, or what courses to take. Pretty big job. I'm not sure that I did well on that, because I was probably not ready for it. Anyway, I guess it lasted a year, and I, of course, most of the steps to making Admiral.
Where was the task force operating?
Off the South Seas, off the China coast, mostly. And we were kind of interested in China at that time, I guess, and all the goings on in 1960.
Queen Moy and Matson.
And also Vietnam. And we did an operation over Vietnam with the P-2s, photographic planes. These are the large photographic land-based planes.
Orions?
Orions.
Yeah.
That came from a land base, but we would direct them just as they were off the Vietnam coast, and we were close to the coast at that time, in sections to photograph. They photographed the whole Vietnam, to find out roads. I guess everybody knew that the Vietnam War was brewing or something in about 62. I don't know. Anyway, we're getting ready for it with maps, because we were making maps out of the photographs. And so that was a big operation we had to take care of. We normally went back into Subic Bay for refueling and relaxation. We did other kinds of missions, like atomic attacks with the AD aircraft, the only prop aircraft we had left at that time. Those poor guys had to fly 12 and 14 hours in a single seat, all strapped in, and that was a heck of a job. Anyway, that was about a year's worth of duty, and came back to my wife was at state at Monterey, my family at that time. After that, I got ordered back to the Naval Academy, and which was maybe a disappointment to me at the time, because I know that, well, I'm not going to be immediately promoted to admiral, because the routine was after the ops job, you got a deep draft, which was an oiler or a tanker or something to acquaint you with ship handling before you got a carrier, and then you made admiral or something. That was the steps that they were running then. But that would be a go to sea for 6 years or so. My wife was delighted that I didn't get that. So I got ordered to the Naval Academy. After I got there, I said, boy, this is great. And I was appointed as head of the Department of Engineering. And
this would have been 61?
This
62.
And of course we had Roger Staubach on the football team, and we were number two in the country or something like that. And we had a great time going to the football games. But also in the serious work, I got there, and this was the first time an aviator had been the head of the engineering department, because they'd had engineering duty officers only in the engineering department. And when you walked into the engineering department, it's a bunch of old boilers sitting there, and old turbines, and all this junk sitting in the display department. I said, holy smoke, let's get rid of that junk. But the opportunity came, and we decided, somebody decided, now I hope it was the admiral or something, it must have been, because it worked, and it started, that we had to upgrade the whole curricula. And nobody wants to study steam anymore. We know all about steam. What about aeronautics? What about space and stuff like that? And what about intricate navigations in the sky, you know, and stuff like that? Well, we decided to rework the whole curricula and have something for the excellent students that they could get extra credit for, and maybe even get enough for a master's degree. And of course we had to go through accreditation and everything else. I had a very good experience going through the accreditation board. The admiral, of course, had lunch for all the accreditation board that came down to look us over, and all the head of the departments were there. And what do you know, I recognized a guy over there. Trying to think of his name. Professor Dubuque, or something like that, from Baltimore. my high school professor, my high school. And I went up to him and said, I'm Vic Rowney. I'm a Poly boy. He says, I would have known it. And I invited him to lunch over at the house, and it was a great experience for me to have my old high school guy come over and see that, well, maybe I did do a good job. Oh boy. Anyway, we did work very hard on the curricula, and I put in an aeronautical program, and I hired an aeronautical professor, and I went back for my 60th 2 years ago, and he was still there 30 years later. So I figured
good choice, then.
That was a pretty good job. I had fun doing it, too. All right, so after the Naval Academy, I got I got an air station, a small air station, Point Magoo, California, as commander of the air station. Well, of course, that was a small job on the staff of the Pacific Missile Range, who was an admiral. He's the admiral in charge of the Pacific Missile Range. It's stationed at Point Magoo. It's a very technical system now, because Vandenberg shoots the missiles, and the Navy is in control of the range and all the telemetry that goes on to controlling the missile and targeting the missile and everything else, which I didn't have anything to do with. I was just running the air station. It was kind of a support activity for them. But it was interesting. I had a nice house, and I had a beach house. And when we had to put in, on the 4th of July or something, I had to put on a brunch for the citizens out there, out in town. But I had a lot of help, because I had all the stewards come in and help put on the breakfast. We did have a nice house the Navy provided, and we did have an automobile that the Navy provided, and we did have a steward that the Navy provided, so it was high life, you know. But I suppose the deprivations of going to sea are rewarded by coming home and having shore duty. After that, I got another air station, which was Moffett Field, California, at Sunnyvale, Mountain View. It's just the heart of Silicon Valley. And I bought a little house worth $40,000 in 1968. I retired there. I retired after that. They wanted me back in Washington for a pretty high-powered job, and I said, she wouldn't go. She says, I'm not going to Washington. So I gave up and retired, see. But I must say, I missed making admiral by not going to Washington. And I could have done it, because it was an admiral's job. But anyway, that's the way it goes.
When was that, 1968?
Is that when you retired? 68, I retired. Mm-hmm. And she died in 99. And I sold that house for $40,000 I paid for it. I sold it for $750. No taxes, no nothing. That's a little bit of inflation, you know. Not only inflation, but everybody wanted to buy a house in Silicon Valley at that time.
Sure.
But I always say that's a little bit of inflation because we have to still pay for going to the moon. And my old professor at Caltech says, we have the technology to go to the moon, 1950. But we'll never have enough money to do it. He doesn't know anything about the U.S. government, you know. End of story.
Well, I thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay, yes, sir.